think I owe someone an apology. And that someone is sitting right here in the studio with me at Ask an Atheist. This is Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey, but Sam's off today. He got me, Becky, in the studio, and I've got Dan and Paul. How are you guys doing?
We're doing just fine.
I'm doing great.
So the apology is because I did prompt a little bit through our social media feeds at Ask an Atheist WA on Twitter and same place on Facebook. A Vietnam vet, a biologist, and a language teacher walk into a studio. What do you ask them? And while we got someone else saying, hey, where's the beer? One of our favorite Twitter users and responders, favorite I say because his name is hilarious, or her name is, or their name is hilarious. This is Urethromancer on Twitter, who says...
Oh, what now?
Yes, precisely. Urethromancer. I can't think of any biolinguists who went to Vietnam, as the field has only existed since 1974. Who is this person? Well, sorry to disappoint you, Urethromancer. We are an unholy trinity of a language teacher, a biologist, and Paul, I owe you the real apology, because... turns out you don't really appreciate being identified as a Vietnam vet. You got some complex feelings on that, don't you?
I do. Quite seriously, I do. I'm taken back whenever somebody says that, because I'm not a typical vet, for one, and I'm very anti-war, which kind of makes sense.
There's a good chunk of you guys that came back from that particular experience being anti-war. If I'm not mistaken,
it does. The big thing is I'm taken back because I have mixed feelings about being a vet. I feel like I was kind of used. Although I spent 20 years in the military, I was brought up to be in the military. I think that was an honorable thing for me. Vietnam was not.
Got it. Got it. So, Urethromancer, I don't know what you would want to ask if we were literally one person, a biolinguist who had been to Vietnam. Dan, as the actual bio part of that that trinity, have you ever heard of biolinguists?
I have not. My immediate reaction is to take it apart in etymological terms and just assume that this is somebody who studies living tongues.
Got it. Wonder what Urethromancer thinks of that.
Can we just say that name one more time?
Go ahead. Be my guest and say that name.
Urethromancer.
So... here on Ask an Atheist, we like covering things that are of interest to atheists and humanists and science-minded people. We hold very closely to an idea of, separation of church and state. And while religious freedom is enshrined in our Constitution and in many state constitutions, we really want to make sure it doesn't go too far and infringe on anyone else's right to be free from other people's religions. I just want to ask you guys a few questions that a particular business owner, a boss, had asked her employee, because this is just baffling to me, of what you would ever do if your employer asked you something like, what's your church background? You know, we know that that's actually not something that an employer or a prospective employer can ask you, right? Unless you're applying specifically for a position within a religious organization. But have you ever gotten asked what your church background is by an employer or a prospective employer?
Not like in a job interview, but conversationally, just as sort of like a getting to know you kind of thing. But I've never had it come up as an issue, I guess.
In the military, yes.
And how does that go? I mean, in the military, when someone
I just didn't answer.
All right. So leave it a mystery to someone else. So I've had students ask me in a public school context, and usually I respond back, how would my answer change how you think of me as your teacher? And they said, huh, okay, that means you're not going to tell us, are you? I've also had students, invite me to particular events and things like that, if they have their confirmation ceremonies or things like that. And I say, yes, I would love to come and support you in this. And I've gone to some of those and some I've declined due to, other kinds of commitments. How about in one word, who is Jesus Christ to you?
Dead.
in a book.
That's three words, Paul. You already failed the quiz.
So there you go.
Seems kind of inappropriate for a boss in a non-religious workplace to be asking that, right? I mean, as someone who is specifically non-religious, I would be very alienated by that. But I imagine even someone who is religious, you might say, oh, why are they asking me about this? It's, you know, generally in the United States, kind of a personal thing. And if you get the wrong, if Jesus Christ to you is someone different than what your employer is asking, that could pose some problems. You know, I mean, it does kind of remind me of the ad campaign that was up on billboards for a while with the Jesus is blank and sort of fill in your own blank. A lot of sort of the newer Christian denominations want you to have a personal relationship with Jesus. And I don't know if that makes any more sense to me than having a prescribed relationship with Jesus per any kind of doctrine, because to me, neither of it makes sense.
Or like sort of a group cloud relationship with Jesus. I ostensibly I have a relationship with the governor of my state, but it's not like a personal relationship.
Oh, so you're more like Jesus as the governor. Okay.
Honestly, I was just trying to think of a relationship that isn't personal that can be described in words.
So how about if someone asked you, were you conceived out of wedlock?
That would be a weird question.
That would be a weird question, yeah.
How about, that seems a little weird for you? Okay, well, maybe this one will put you at ease. Have you ever made a pact with the devil? Dan?
Billy!
Paul, have you ever made a pact with the devil?
But of course.
How about, have you ever been involved in Eastern religion?
Like, involved how? Like deified or, like, at a ceremony?
You failed the quiz already on that one. Have you ever visited heathen temples, Dan?
Oh.
Heathen temples. Wait, that's a... You know what? I don't think I have actually ever seen a heathen temple in my life.
Paul, were you personally involved in building heathen temples?
I went just one in...
I went to a heathen barbecue a couple of times.
What were you being barbecued? What was being barbecued? What were you being served?
Wild boar.
Do you have any witches, such as good luck kitchen witches, in your home?
Only when Libby comes to visit.
Two cats.
Oh, are they your familiars, Paul?
Absolutely.
Okay, all right. So let's see. To your knowledge, was there evidence of lust in your family line?
Oh, absolutely not.
I mean, most certainly.
I'm pretty sure that I am the walking evidence of lust in my family line. I wouldn't be here if there hadn't been any.
So here's the thing. These questions sound completely inappropriate, right? From someone other than maybe a religious denomination that you choose to participate in. And I'll tell you guys, these quiz questions, I only gave you the questions that were safe to really disclose on the radio, because these questions were asked to someone in particular at his workplace.
That is amazing.
And he is suing. I would say thank goodness that he is suing, or thank our legal system for his ability to have a lawsuit, because a former Hampton Inn desk clerk in Kentucky is suing his boss after she instituted a campaign of religious harassment and retaliation for the clerk's failure to participate in religious rituals. Jason Fields of Leslie County, Kentucky, filed suit against former manager Sharon Linden for subjecting him to extreme personal questioning, demands to undergo exorcism, work schedule changes to the undesirable third shift, and threats of being fired. What's so funny about being switched to your...
we've got you know, the extreme personal questioning, demands to undergo exorcism, work schedule changes to the undesirable third shift. I'm not sure that one's legally actionable, but let's move on.
That's the retaliation portion we're doing. If you're usually work during daylight hours and they say, hey, you won't participate in an exorcism, you won't answer these quiz questions of what church you belong to, and if you've ever been a part of cults and made pacts with the devil, I'm going to put you on the crappiest, least desirable work shift. That's absolutely the definition of retaliation.
Fair enough. I guess I was seeing it as a kind of in the string of things that went along with the religious weirdness. I was like, well, that's not so bad. But in retaliation, I understand.
Well, and in addition to that, he was also subjected to threats of being fired, all because Linden believed that her employee's forthcoming divorce was caused by demons. Linden even arranged for her church members to gather in the hotel lobby and pray for Fields in the presence of hotel guests. Fields quit his job due to hostile work conditions and is suing for punitive damages and compensation.
Good.
Great.
Can you imagine walking into a hotel? You know, you're on the road, you're driving cross country, maybe you're going to like see grandkids somewhere, or you're going to go visit something, and you stop and make reservations at a Hampton Inn. And there's a charismatic prayer circle going on for the desk clerk guy that's like, I don't know what's up with these guys here. Your room is on the second floor. Ice machine is down on the first. Right.
Because of the heathen witch divorce demons. That's, you know, that's what I think of when I think of like an affordable motel. The Hampton Inn and Suites, famous for its divorce demons.
Let me tell you about divorce demons.
Oh, do tell us. Did you have to undergo exorcism to rid yourself of the divorce demons?
Only one.
So I think that this is really a strength of the legal system when we look at, you know, what are so often frivolous lawsuits or so-called frivolous lawsuits. In my mind, this is not at all frivolous. Now, I don't know whether Mr. Fields is an atheist or not, but per his lawsuit, he was not a member of her church.
Yeah,
probably not.
And he did not, you know, there's nothing that that in my mind should embolden this manager of the hotel to say that this is an appropriate way of interacting with the people that you are supervising.
Right.
So I urge you, if you're curious, guys, go and look at his lawsuit, because there were 26 questions, A through Z, literally A through Z. And some of them were definitely more personal than, has there been lust in your family bloodline, or did you make a pact with the devil?
And they can't even be on air.
Ever engaged in cross-phylum relations?
That's a way of putting it with advanced vocabulary.
There you go.
So in terms of folks that think that they can exorcise anything using a ritual, something that is part of the natural process of being human and, you know, living, you know, maybe you pick a mate, a significant other that you've fallen out of favor with, or they've fallen out of favor with you. And you know what? In my mind, as someone who doesn't use religious laws to say, if I'm once married, that's it forever. You know, we have a friend who took in her wedding vows saying, do you promise to love and treasure and cherish this person and help each other for as long as you still love each other? And I like that.
Yeah, that seems fair.
Yeah.
That's what we had.
And you know, to say that you're going to, that's the, when you decide that you no longer love each other or that you cannot be married to each other anymore, to say that that's the work of demons and we must cast them out, seems ridiculous on its face. But at the same time, you have religious sects that are saying that part of the regular human experience can be cast out like demons, like part of the panoply of human experiences of being LGBT. And to that end, I want to bring us to some good news, guys, because okay. Puerto Rican Governor Ricardo Rosselló signed into law a bill that bans so-called gay conversion therapy. Rosselló was proud to raise awareness that the controversial practice causes pain and suffering, and also noted that the ban would protect children. Puerto Rico joins D.C., 15 states, including Washington, and many U.S. counties in banning therapies designed to reorient sexual attraction.
That's nice to hear some good news once in a while.
Yes, it is.
I think that it's complex coming from Puerto Rico, and we oftentimes forget about Puerto Rico being, you know, anything other than the target of, you know, hurricanes and of, you know, slurs and what's it called when you talk smack about someone, you know, on
lambasting,
the part of
yeah,
lambasting on the part of our political leaders or supposed political leaders. But Puerto Rico has, you know, U.S. citizens there that are also ones that should and need to be protected from these religiously influenced practices that in some states have been called fraud and in other states have been really lambasted for good reasons for really causing pain and suffering. I was interested, though, to note that, you know, 15 states plus D.C. and Puerto Rico and counties. And to me, that looks like all politics is local, because if you can't ban something that's tragic and harmful to someone at your state level, you can do it at the county level, usually, interestingly, through your business boards and sort of business regulations, because when you offer therapy to someone and you have a client and they are paying you money, you are doing a business. And if your business practice is something that is harmful to someone, that offers something under fraudulent terms because it is recognized by, you know, medical practitioners and scientists that this is not a being gay or being LGBT is not a failure that needs treatment.
It is not an illness.
It isn't. Mm-hmm. It was stricken from our books, you know, far too late, in my opinion, but in the early 70s as an illness that requires treatment. So when you are offering your business services as if being LGBT is something that requires treatment, you are offering fraudulent business practices.
There you go.
So, Paul, in your experience as a medical professional, because you spent 20 years as an EMT and nurse and EMT instructor, how have you seen that kind of change happen in terms of the medical community accepting LGBT folks as just part of the variety of human existence?
Okay, as far as paramedic, I retired from that back in 2000, so that I'm talking about 18 years back. And at that time, it was not the greatest. We had a lot of building to do, transgender, and it just.
Do you think that
transvestite would set paramedics off?
So even just first responders not being able to sort of deal face to face with someone's medical emergency and separate it from sort of what they might look like on the outside or present.
They were taken for medical purposes, but it was shameful. It was shameful how they were treated. I understand that it has changed drastically in the 18 years since I left, and I saw changes while I was there. It wasn't across the board.
And you practiced in a number of states, from Washington to Texas and all over. So I'm sure that you saw some of the different cultural norms in each of those geographic places as well. Is that right?
True.
Well, I'm glad that we've done the building since then. I definitely think that since we only have 15 states that ban conversion therapy, we still have a lot of building left to go. You're listening to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. And we'll be back after the break to, I don't know, dissect some velociraptors, I guess. Not literally. not literal velociraptor dissection, but I think I'm going to need to bring in our bio, part of our biolinguist veteran.
Yeah.
Hello and welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Still got me in for Sam today. I'm Becky, and I got Dan and Paul in here. And there was something that came up last month, or I don't know, a few weeks ago, that was utterly puzzling to me as an atheist, as a woman, as someone who does not have children at age 37, and, well, generally, as an American. And that is that Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah claimed during debate over new Green Deal legislation that the solution to so many of our problems at all times and in all places is to fall in love, get married, and have some kids. Well, as someone in the room, Paul, who has fallen in love, got married, and had kids, you personally, single-handedly, solved all the world's problems, right?
Of course I did.
I mean, there's no pollution anymore contaminating our aquifers, right?
Every time I go outside.
Okay. There's the weather's fine. We don't have any catastrophic flooding or heat waves or, you know, dust storms or anything like that.
They're all done.
Okay. Politics is completely sane again, right? You solved that.
I don't go that far.
Oh, okay. Oh, so you're doubting a little bit Mr. Mike Lee, who says that the solution is to get married, have some kids, right? Because while offering criticism of bills addressing climate change, Lee contrasted a poster of Aquaman riding a seahorse to an image of former President Ronald Reagan firing a machine gun and riding atop a velociraptor holding a tattered American flag. Lee called the latter a symbol of all that it means to be American. He argued that the planet doesn't need for us to think globally and act locally so much as it needs us to think family and act personally. As a secular humanist, that's kind of like absolutely against the entire philosophy of humanism, that the only thing you do is act personally for yourself and, you know, for your immediate family that you have, you know, procreated to form. And Mr. Lee, sorry, wrong. You are so wrong. I'm just going to say it. You know, and some folks might think that this charade of showing these ridiculous posters. Have you seen this poster?
I did, in fact, see the Ronald Reagan with a machine gun and an American flag riding a velociraptor poster. And all I could think of was, like, I didn't realize Fallout 6 was out yet.
I know, right? If you had only just fallen in love, gotten married, and had a children, it would have occurred to you already.
Right.
No, so a lot of folks are thinking that this is actually in response to something that congressional champion and climate change action, you know, advocate Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez had spoken about, because back in February, she live streamed on her Instagram that there's scientific consensus that the lives of children are going to be very difficult. The current children that we have, the generation under 18, their lives are going to be difficult. And why? Well, because of climate change and the political and resource fights that will, you know, happen around that. Just living healthfully, you know, will be more difficult. And she argued that that sort of, you know, knowledge actually leads a lot of young people to question what she called a legitimate question. She says, is it okay to still have children? And this posed from a humanist standpoint, a very interesting ethical question for me, because it looks at, is it okay to have children because it's going to be difficult for them? And then there's a lot of folks that say, is it okay to have children because of the sheer environmental impact that having another child, especially in the United States, where we're very resource intensive and resource hungry, you know, because of all the things that that causes. And so I thought, Dan, I'd bring you in on this about what is the environmental impact of having a child, and how does that inform our ethical decision of whether to procreate or not?
Well, when I was in college, I had an ecology professor who was notoriously blunt. And when asked during our class, what's the best thing that we could do for the environment? He said, number one, die. Number two, don't have kids. After that, doesn't really matter. It's all pretty trivial.
That's pretty grim. I mean, when you think of atheists, there's folks that think, well, all atheists are nihilists. And, you know, but secular humanism does actually concern itself with the welfare of individuals. And I can't imagine anyone who, you know, holds a positive philosophy of life saying, no, the best thing you can do is die. And the next best thing you can do is just, you know.
Well, he was being a bit hyperbolic. However, the point stands. Having a child is the largest ecological impact you can have, period. So Lund University in Sweden found that having one less child saves the equivalent of about 58.6 tons of CO2 emissions per parent per year. The annual amount of CO2 saved by having one fewer child is approximately 700 times higher than the lifetime CO2 savings of one person recycling.
Okay, so if I recycle all my cans and paper and everything and for my entire life, I would actually have to have 700 people doing that for their entire life to equal the CO2, to equal out and balance out the CO2 caused by if I were to have one kid.
For 1 year.
Oh, just for 1 year.
For one year.
So if the kid lives till 70, I would have to have 700 times 70.
Correct.
Okay. That puts things in a big perspective. One thing that I was, you know, considering when I'm like, well, you know, I want to plan my life and I want to be a responsible individual. And if I were to have a child, maybe, and knowing that that's a huge environmental impact, maybe I can at that point say I'm going to give up meat because I know meat eating is really resource intensive.
Sure. If you go vegan, that'll save about 0.8 tons of CO2 per year. So about 1/73 of the impact of a child.
So going vegan really isn't enough to balance out having
not remotely. And it changes a little bit if you have pets. If you have carnivorous pets like cats or dogs, well, they actually consume about 25% of the total meat produced in the United States. So not owning a carnivorous pet or a carnivorous cat or dog is pretty similar in impact to recycling, about 0.21 tons of CO2 per year saved.
You're coming after my kittens, Dan.
I'm not coming after your kittens. I'm not going to, we're not going to say, you know, that this thing that you're doing is evil and this is the sole responsible, you know, this is the only path forward. I mean, we have to talk about this stuff in realistic terms. We have to be flexible. Our pets do provide a lot of good for us as human beings that help to keep us sane, that help to keep us compassionate. And honestly, our kids do the same for us. But the fact of the matter is, right now, our planet is overburdened resource-wise with the number of people here using our resources. So I'm not saying go kill everybody, but I'm saying what we need is negative population growth, at least for a few generations. So that means if you are two parents, consider stopping at one child. If you haven't really thought about children, if it's not that big a drive in your life, maybe consider not having children. If you really want to have kids, if you really want to have a family, consider adopting or fostering a child. Those kids are still alive. They're going to use resources just like you're, just like, you know, a newborn baby would. But it's half the resources if you adopt or foster rather than having another kid.
So for those who do choose to have children and who have had maybe more than one or two or three children, what are the kinds of things, you know, we say, okay, well, we want to minimize our environmental impact. So recycling actually is like has very little environmental impact in terms of reducing CO2 or not adding as much CO2, right? I mean, there's other things like keeping stuff out of landfills or keeping, you know, plastics out of, you know, water.
That sort
like
of all
that.
Falls under the recycling umbrella. There's a lot of those small things that we can do. But after not having a child, they shrink really quick. So having a child at 58.6 tons is the biggest impact you can have. A transatlantic flight uses about 2.8 tons of CO2. So that is the next largest impact you can have is flying across the Atlantic. And this is talking one flight per year. After that, not having a car saves about 2.4 tons of CO2 per year. So taking one less flight across the Atlantic in a year is actually better for the environment than not having a car, period.
Huh. Okay. So if I were to have a car because I need it for my commute, but I'm looking at maybe, you know, with some of my tax return money, using that and doing a trip to Europe. Mm-hmm. I say, you know, I haven't been to Europe and I want to go explore, you know, Prague. I take that tax return money. I don't fly across the Atlantic to Prague, but instead I take a drive down to the Grand Canyon and experience something else that I haven't really done before. That actually has less environmental impact.
Tremendously less. Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Next down the line is buying green energy. So most municipalities now that get their energy from multiple sources allow you to change the way that your money is being used. I believe Tacoma Power actually has this option locally where you can say, okay, I don't want power that's coming from any fossil fuel sources. I want power that's coming from hydroelectric or solar or wind. I believe we have all three of those in our municipality. And that will save you about 1.5 tons of CO2 per year, about 1/40th of having a kid. If you go vegan, that's about 1/73rd of having a kid. If you wash clothes in cold water every time you do your laundry instead of hot, that saves about 1/4 of a ton of CO2 per year, which is actually more than the impact of recycling. That's about 1/5 of a ton of CO2 per year. But bringing a child into this world is by far the biggest one, and not just on a one-year basis. It's estimated that bringing a child into the world creates an average of 9,441 metric tons of new CO2 emissions per lifetime per child. That's actually 5.7 times the lifetime impact of a person who's already living today. That sounds a little crazy, but the reason is that that new child will probably have children of their own, and those children are likely to do the same. So while not having a child offers a pretty flat rate CO2 cutoff at about 57 tons, having a child means an exponential increase of unknown proportions, which continues even into the distant future.
So a lot of ethical things to really ponder here in terms of our environmental impact and in terms of how those future generations will experience life, you know, if we don't turn around some of these really, really serious and grave environmental impacts. kind of a really interesting question. You know, I wish this could all be solved by a ridiculous poster of a velociraptor and machine guns and former presidents who were movie stars, and as opposed to, you know, current presidents who are reality stars.
Right.
I mean, it's kind of messy, you know, and it's really interesting. I think that at the end of it, though, when you're saying we should just ignore any of this new Green Deal legislation in favor of thinking personally and for oneself, I, as an educated person and as a humanist, don't really understand. This is one of those things that I have a hard time empathizing with. I can't really get in the headspace of someone that would say, I'm going to stick my head in the sand and ignore what's going to happen. Because even if you are, as the senator from Utah thinks, you know, family focused, you got to think at least of the family that you do have and what their life will be like in the future.
Absolutely.
So, Paul, as you've seen your own children and then now your grandchildren, you know, look towards the future, do you sort of get in that headspace of saying, what's the future going to hold for my grandchildren as they age and as they come up to my level? You say you don't have an age, right? You're up to
levels. I'm at level 72.
Nice. Okay, you're leveling up well.
There you go. Thank you. Yes, I'm terrified.
And do you ever get tempted to say, well, it would be easier if I could just pray to something or someone, or if there was a supernatural power that could save this, or some deus ex machina, like let's have faith in all of the scientists and engineers to invent a huge carbon sink that will take all the CO2 out of the world.
Oh, dear.
I can't think like that.
Just anathema to who you are. Yeah. So, yep. You know, Dan, you talked a little bit about the power, okay? And, well, let's see. Last week, there was something in the news about some of these green powers. And we touched on it a little bit because it was baffling to me that someone could think that you could get cancer from the noises that an industrial wind turbine might make. And that's why we shouldn't have wind power, in someone's view. So I thought, as someone, you know, who really looks at, you know, environmentalism and conservation, you know, I would ask you, Dan, a little bit about all of making sense out of all of these different ways of obtaining our energy.
Sure.
So we always hear that coal is bad.
Yes.
But there's some politicians that say that there's a such thing as a clean form of coal.
Well, there's no such thing as clean coal. There is somewhat cleaner coal, but it still comes out leading the pack in the dirtiest possible ways of generating power. Coal is bad. Clean coal is slightly less bad. So what they do to create clean coal power, they have kind of a number of things. One, they wash the coal. So crushed coal, which is what you see going across the trains, you know, small chunks about sugar cube size, roughly. They wash that in a fluid. They do not disclose what that fluid is composed of. But the theory is that some of the impurities will then settle out when it is washed in the fluid.
And then what happens to the fluid? I mean, does that just go back into like our natural environment? Does it?
That's
a big
question mark.
Is there regulations for like processing of this fluid?
A big question mark.
Okay.
So then there's wue scrubbers, and wue scrubbers use the flue gas. That's the smoke coming out of the chimneys at a coal plant is flue gas. So wue scrubbers use water and limestone to control the flue gas emissions, basically by spraying that mixture of water and limestone into the smoke, thinking that those things will sort of like grab all of the nastiness out of the smoke. And it does have the pleasant side effect of creating synthetic gypsum, the same stuff that drywall is made out of. But the smoke still remains pretty filthy. Then there's low NOx burners. They restrict how much oxygen is in the combustion chamber at the coal plant. And that lowers the amount of nitrous oxide gas coming out. Now, nitrous oxide gas is an important greenhouse gas.
Well, that's the laughing gas, right? That's the one at the dentist when you get a little bit loopy.
Yes and no. There's a little bit more to it. When this stuff gets up in the atmosphere, it causes reactions that create other things like nitric oxide or nitric acid. Anyhow.
Oh, and that's the acid rain causing things.
No, that's sulfur dioxide. Okay. We're getting to that too, don't worry.
I'm with you.
So they have the low NOx burners to create how much nitrous oxide comes out. They also have electrostatic precipitators. Now, some of us, I'm sure, remember the ionic breeze, those trendy things that you'd put in the office, and they would capture the ions out of the air to make the air cleaner. Not a lot of evidence that they make a huge difference, except in industrial settings. But there are electrostatic precipitators now in some coal plants that capture some of the particulate in much the same way as the ionic breeze would, using static electricity. There's also gasification plants where the coal isn't burned, but it's heated and pressurized into syngas. Basically, that's a mixture of carbon monoxide and hydrogen. And then the syngas is burned to generate electricity.
This all sounds really dirty still.
It's still pretty dirty. Another major concern about coal is clean coal or otherwise. It still uses about 400 gallons of water per megawatt hour. Now, that's just in a cooling capacity. And we're not talking about water that's being recirculated there. We're talking about water that is lost. So about 400 gallons per megawatt hour. The next concern with coal is toxic sludge. Coal ash is full of all kinds of toxic compounds, heavy metals, even trace amounts of radioactive materials. And that toxic sludge is not easily disposed of.
Okay, you have convinced me clean coal is nothing but coal. It's coal that's dirty, and then it makes other stuff dirty in order to be slightly less dirty itself.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right.
So, you mentioned, well, we should talk about wind, right? Because, you know, it looks like that, you know, if I wasn't scared that that coal was going to, you know, give me any kind of cancerous, you know, effects, I should at least avoid windmills, right?
Well, you know, when we go down the list here, you'll find that wind kind of comes in the winning position.
It really is the winning position.
It really is the winning position.
Well, what's some of the other stuff? Because we've heard about hydro and tidal forces to make energy, right?
Right. So I've ranked these by their carbon impact. And what we're looking at is pounds of CO2 per kilowatt hour. So how much CO2 is released into the atmosphere per kilowatt hour of electricity that we get out of this kind of energy generation? That's also taking into effect things like transportation of fuels, cement construction to build any of these different kinds of plants, equivalent emissions with things like strip mining and all that. So we've tried to be pretty inclusive. So next after quote unquote clean coal is biomass. And this is basically where you're taking the waste from agriculture. This might be human or animal waste. It can be the chaff from separating crops out. And you sort of burn it in a big reactor and use that to generate electricity. It has most of the same problems that coal does as far as its carbon impact. But the fuel for it can be sustainably sourced. And there's little to no toxic sludge when you're looking at agricultural or human waste.
Would this be the equivalent of using a wood-burning stove in your own home as a way to get energy? Because, you know, trees... biomass,
yeah, similar.
Right?
Yeah. Okay. And a wood burning stove, while the smoke contains, you know, carcinogenic particulates and things like that, a wood burning stove, you can at least say it is sustainably fueled. You can grow more trees. We cannot get more coal. Next down the line is natural gas at about 0.6 to 2 pounds of CO2 per kilowatt hour.
Now, Paul, out where you are, right, it's a little bit hard to, continuously have, different... You want to have a mix of energy, and you've got some natural gas out there, right?
I've got propane.
Okay, all right. And that's for your heating and, just general things out where you are, right? Because in the rural area.
Correct.
So not as bad as... the dirty coal.
Well, there's some distinction here. Propane is not natural gas.
Okay.
Methane is natural gas. Propane is actually a byproduct of the petroleum industry. Propane comes from drilling oil.
Oh, damn. So still not
clean.
Okay.
So natural gas comes in at about 0.6 to 2 pounds of CO2 per kilowatt hour. The problem with it, the biggest problem that we know of, is an unknown but tremendous amount of methane leakage.
So how do we know that it's tremendous if we don't actually know how much?
It's sort of a simple matter of numbers. We know that gas meters leak. Anybody who has ever been around the gas meter outside their house has smelled that smell of methane, which is not the gas itself, but a sort of a stinky compound they add in it so that we can detect leaks. Multiply that by the number of houses that are being powered by or heated by natural gas, and you get a huge, huge amount of off-gassing. Now, what's not known and is a little bit harder to figure out is how much of it is lost during the actual procuring of this gas in the first place. Most natural gas is obtained by fracking, and fracking is not a completely pressure-contained way of doing anything. When you blow a hole into the earth to try to separate layers of rock apart from each other, that gas is getting out, and it's not just getting out up your machinery or your equipment. It's getting out of your well. It's getting out through other fissures in the earth. And then the second problem with fracking is water pollution. So we know that fracking can affect our aquifers. We don't know exactly what chemicals are in fracking fluids, but we know that many of them are flammable or hazardous or in other ways harmful to humans. And then on top of that, fracking causes earthquakes.
Yeah, we saw an uptick of the last several years in Oklahoma, where it was generally a very seismologically stable area, and suddenly have these little rumbly earthquakes, and kind of attributable to a lot of the hydraulic fracturing, right?
Right, right. About 10 years ago, it was sort of speculative that maybe this fracking causes earthquakes, and now the science is very well settled. Fracking certainly causes earthquakes. It is a causal relationship. Moving on from natural gas, the next one we're going to look at is hydropower. Now, there's a couple different ways of doing hydropower. You can have small run-of-river projects, which don't really involve a large dam, or you can have reservoir-type projects, which involve a very large dam. So depending on which kind you're doing, that's either 0.01 to 0.5 pounds of CO2 per kilowatt hour.
Now, you have been on Ask an Atheist before, Dan, as someone who is has brought to the fore a lot of the problems with at least our hydropower through our dams in our state and in our region.
Absolutely. Yeah. The reservoir-based hydropower is, well, it's an old experiment, and it's an experiment that we need to walk away from for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is land use. Anywhere from 2.5 to 2,000 acres per megawatt. There are numerous wildlife impacts, from fragmented habitat, eutrophication of the waters, heat pollution, invasive species, opportunistic predation. The water loss to evaporation from reservoirs is huge. You actually lose more water from evaporation putting in a reservoir for irrigation than you would if you drew it directly from the river. And sort of the last one here is one that's a little bit more, well, angering. And those are social justice issues. The places that these large dams are put are not accidental, and they're not always put in the best place to have a large dam. Frequently, especially in the state of Washington, they have been placed in order to flood indigenous peoples out of their home, cut them off from their sources of culture, and cut them out from their resources available.
We see that not just in Washington state, but in a lot of places in South America with the Amazon. We see this in China with generations of individuals that have been in a particular region for a very long time. You know, we saw that in Brazil, there was a major breach that then put other people in danger and killed upwards of 70 individuals just from flooding.
And let's be clear here with the hydropower companies that are doing this and the governments that are cooperating with them in these projects, this is a feature, not a bug. This is deliberate. These dams are a tool for taking people away from these culture. These dams are a tool for genocide. All right, moving on. Did I mention that small run-of-river projects are actually quite sustainable?
Oh, are they?
They are. Now, next in line would actually be nuclear. Nuclear is about 0.01 to 0.04 pounds of CO2 per kilowatt hour.
So there's a lot of folks that have environmental concerns and say that they are completely anti-nuclear. We need to denuclearize everything, whether it's weapons or power generation.
Right.
But you're saying that actually in terms of how dirty a power source it is, nuclear is less dirty than hydro dams.
Right. Nuclear is cleaner than coal. It's cleaner than biomass. It's cleaner than natural gas. And it's cleaner than hydro. Now, it's not the best one on this list, but it's a lot lower impact than the ones that we've talked about previously. Its major impacts have to do with things like strip mining for uranium and other metals. Waste disposal is a big conundrum. We still don't know what to do with it. We've been putting it in caves. We've been putting it in sealed containers on the surface of the earth. We don't have a lot of instances of nuclear waste leaking out once it's been contained, but there's only so much space for containment.
So if it's not quite the best of the things, what are some of the best ones?
So the best ones that we're looking at, wind tops the list by far. Right now, it's actually cheaper to build a new wind farm than it is to maintain an existing coal plant. So it's not just cheap to run. It's actually cheaper to build. So wind is about 0.02 to 0.04 pounds of CO2 per kilowatt hour. The land use is often stated as a concern, that it's about 30 to 140 acres per megawatt, with 2 megawatts being produced by each turbine. Each turbine spaced about 5 rotor diameters apart. That's just so there's sort of enough wind to go around and to prevent collisions. But less than 1 acre per megawatt is actually disturbed permanently, meaning once construction is over, you can get back to, you know, using the rest of the land. And less than 3.5 acres per megawatt is even disturbed at all during construction.
So you could presumably have a wind farm with an agricultural farm combined.
Right.
It's
something that's actually becoming pretty common with farmers in the Midwest. Especially struggling smaller farms have found that they can lease out a section of their land to energy companies to build windmills. And while the windmill is a tall, slender device and does have a shadow, it's a very small shadow that moves across the ground pretty quickly, doesn't actually interrupt their ability to grow their crops or to have their land grazed. You can also have windmills out in wildland. You can have hiking trails through them. Wind really doesn't do a whole lot of damage to the land permanently, whereas even with something as cool as a nuclear plant, once it's decommissioned, you can't just return that land to normal usage. You have to go through decades of remediation and trying to build everything back together.
Now, some folks really think that this is, especially on the East Coast, where we've all spent a little bit of time, that this, especially with offshore wind farms, that it would, you know, be really ugly. And I don't know why changing your vista and your view in this way is suddenly something that is... that warrants, you know, saying, no, we can't do this. Because in my mind, when I am driving across the country and when I go to, you know, the east side of the mountains, and I see wind farms, I actually find them strikingly beautiful. I think to myself, when we have used the powers of human ingenuity to build something that is so much cleaner, so much less destructive and disruptive to our environment and to, you know, our activities as well, I'm inspired by them. I don't know how you guys feel. Do you like the look of the windmills?
I like the look of the windmills, and I especially like when I'm driving by seeing that the farmland all around them is being used as farmland.
Absolutely. When I see those windmills in the distance, you know, at first I thought that they were just sort of strange and awkward looking, but once I really learned what they're doing, They sort of took on their own sort of beauty. You know, when I see a wind farm out there in the mountains or even offshore, what I see is humans learning and humans doing better. I think there's even a sense of pride in being a human and being an environmentalist, even in being a scientist, looking at those windmills and being like, here's people who are trying. Here's people who are getting better.
Progress.
I definitely feel you on that. We've got a little bit time left. I think that we're going to look from something inspirational to something also creative when we come back after the break. But maybe not something that'll save us from environmental destruction. You're listening to Ask an Atheist. Hello and welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. You know, right before the break, we were talking about the impact of our major energy sources, and we found out that wind was the best in terms of what can reduce the amount of CO2 put into the atmosphere. But, Dan, I cut you off a little bit early. There were a few other ones that are also pretty good in terms of being cleaner power.
Right, yeah. As far as clean power goes, wind is definitely the best. The close second would be hydrokinetic. That would be wave or tidal energy. However, nobody's really installed one on a large scale yet. So there's a few unknowns. Coming in third is going to be geothermal. And fourth would be solar.
Wait, geothermal? That's if Mount St. Helens is kind of puffing its way. And can we harness that energy?
Yeah, so geothermal, you usually use it at volcanic hotspots. Water is pumped through a series of pipes deep into the ground, where that water is then heated up by molten rock in the earth. The hot water coming back up to the surface then generates a steam, or turns a steam turbine. And that's how you generate electricity.
So not great for a lot of parts of our Earth, or at least our country, but really good for places like Iceland.
Right, sure. And if you are on or near a fault, or even if you have sort of shallower bedrock, you can drill down. So you don't necessarily have to be in a volcanically active place to implement geothermal, but it helps.
So after geothermal?
After geothermal would be solar. So the reason that solar doesn't really top the list here is that, there's two main kinds. There is concentrated solar power that's using parabolic mirrors that all kind of point together at one single target, which is the steam generator. And that's kind of like a magnifying glass on a hot, sunny day. The other kind is photovoltaic, and concentrated solar power, the mirrors, well, those have a huge amount of water use, and they tend to be put in places that are arid regions where water is scarce. So the big impact there isn't in constructing them. The big impact is using water in an area that's already pretty dry.
Well, to get the photovoltaic cells, you also have to do a fair amount of strip mining. Is that
right?
Is that correct?
Right. So that's the other type of solar to do is photovoltaic. And for that, you have to use all kinds of hazardous materials. You have to strip mine to get rare earth metals, but also in the process of manufacturing photovoltaic cells, you're going to use hydrochloric acid, sulfuric acid, nitric acid, hydrogen fluoride, trichloroethane, acetone, and then thin cell photovoltaics, which are the newer variety, also use gallium arsenide, copper indium gallium diselenide, and cadmium telluride.
And now we sound like we're going back to all that, the coal runoff at that point in
right.
terms of all those metals.
It's still significantly cleaner than coal. It's still significantly cleaner than nuclear. But as far as the impacts, really nothing touches wind on clean energy.
I am totally turned on to wind. Noisy wind turbines or no noise.
Just like the turbines, now you're a big fan.
So speaking of being turned on, a New Jersey woman has been charged with criminal mischief after she took a pair of gardening shears to her neighbor's festive, sexy Easter yard decorations. Dr. Wayne Ganji, a dentist in Clifton, New Jersey, whose office is in a residential neighborhood, has featured scantily clad mannequins in various holiday displays over the years, including Halloween, Valentine's Day, and St. Patrick's Day, all with different wardrobes. This month, he'd outfitted the mannequins with pastel-colored wigs, bunny ears, fluffy tails, and Easter baskets with plastic eggs spread across the lawn. Desiree Shepstone allegedly thought the display was tasteless and offensive and destroyed it in full view of a local news camera. Paul, you are renowned in your neck of the woods, literally the neck of the woods, for having wonderful, lurid holiday displays for Halloween. Is that correct?
Halloween and Easter.
Okay. you bring out what kind of things? Are they one and the same? Are they like a bunch of mannequins dressed in fishnet stockings with their little puffy tails? Or what do you got going?
My Halloween is all kinds of Halloween things.
Okay, so the typical zombies and spiders and skeletons?
My Easter is just one zombie.
Oh. And what's that zombie look like?
Well, he's crawling out of the ground.
Okay.
He's got a little crown of thorns.
Oh, I see. So, Paul, I wanted to ask you, have you ever had an irate neighbor say that your zombie Easter decoration is tasteless and offensive?
I've actually gotten compliments. and I've never gotten any repercussions whatsoever, but I did have one of my signs demolished.
Oh, and what year. Sign was that?
I had taken the sign off and left the metal up, and I was going to change signs the next day, and I went out and it was all twisted up and
okay.
all over my yard.
So maybe someone just poking fun at the sign holder, not necessarily the message. Because what are the messages of the signs that you usually have?
I have a whole bunch of them. And they're all kind of anti-religion.
Okay.
Not anti-person, but anti-religion. And I've gotten more compliments than anything else.
Well, I think that this dentist in New Jersey is your counterpart on the East Coast, because he said that after this neighbor destroyed his mannequins with pruning shears, you know, he's going to resurrect his Easter bunnies with bigger and better decorations and maybe pastellier wigs and I don't know. So
we'll build a better Easter display with hookers and blackjack.
What do you think of it in general, Dan? Would this be something that you'd be honored to have in your neighborhood?
You know, I could see somebody being like, boy, I don't think that's appropriate, and like writing a letter, but, you know, getting out the pruning shears and hopping the fence to just chop up a bunch of mannequins is pretty bizarre to me.
I think it would damage your pruning shears. I would like to keep my pruning shears in better condition than that.
I mean, my immediate instinct is to think, oh, that's kind of funny. But on reconsideration, maybe scantily clad mannequins all over the yard of a business is like low-key misogyny. I'm not too good at spotting these things.
His new and improved display will feature a male mannequin. He is searching right now for the appropriate suit to make it as Joe Biden-y as possible. That's that's his that's his goal for his new mannequin display. So are we now not so much low-key by misogyny, but maybe full out?
This whole thing just got really complicated. I'm not really sure what to make heads or tails of this. I will request the assistance of somebody more experienced in social justice causes than myself.
I will say that to me, they are mannequins. They are out there. I can see how maybe tongue-in-cheek bringing in Biden would say, hey, yeah, maybe not so fun on that one. But I love the idea of the play on Easter bunnies, having them be Playboy bunnies. I would love to see them resurrected and, you know, maybe brought out every year. This is Ask an Atheist that you've been listening to. Thank you, Dan, for educating us about wind.
Always happy to help.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
I love being in the studio. Earth Day is coming up. There's lots of events in your local area. Check them out. I think maybe we'll do a little bit more earthy things next week as well. You can find us at Ask an Atheist WA on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook. Email us questions at atheist.radio and listen to all our programs at atheist.radio. See you guys next week.